Hey there, my name's Jared Holt, and welcome to Shitpost, a podcast at the intersection of tech, politics, and culture. Every other Monday, I bring on someone who I think is doing interesting work or has an interesting perspective. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on the player of your choice and check out the newsletter on Substack. There's a link to that in the description. Let's go. What's up, Shitpost listeners? This is your host, Jared Holt. I'm a little bit late to this episode because of that whole getting married thing. I really thought I was going to have time last week to put something together, but then the wheels started turning on all of the ceremony, reception type stuff, and I lost track of time. Sorry if you're disappointed to not see an episode out on Monday, as is usual, and I hope this can start to make it up to you. On a related note, I have some housekeeping to go over. There will be a newsletter out on Monday. I already wrote that one. Sam is editing it now, so I know that one's going to go out on time. But after this episode and that newsletter, I'm off on my honeymoon. It's going to be the trip of a lifetime. It's 2.5 weeks. I'm so pumped about it. If you need to reach me during that time, no, you don't. So I'll be back in mid-August. I'll catch you all then. If you found it in your heart to support this show with a paid subscription over on that Substack, please make sure you read the update on billing that I sent around. Anytime I take a major break that's longer than a week, I pause the billing on the Substack. You don't need to do anything. It's all handled on my end. Anytime you've paid for already, whether it's a month or a year, that will roll over automatically when I unpause the billing. So you're not losing time, you're not losing money, and as much as I appreciate your support, I would feel so wrong to, you know, take cash from you guys when I'm gone. If you have any questions about this, just hit me up directly. We'll work it all out. And with all of that out of the way, I'm thrilled to introduce my next guest, Kristen Doerr.
Thanks for having me.
That, like, fumbled out of my mouth. Doerr. Even when we worked together, I had a hard time pronouncing that. It's like the D-O-E right before the R.
It's just the Doerr, and you just blend it, and it's fine. If it blends a lot, you just say Doerr. Yeah.
Well, Kristen's the managing editor at Right Wing Watch, which most of you will know as a place that I used to write for. And today we're going to talk about the January 6th hearings, and in particular, the one this week that looked at extremism and the internet, which, you know, is right up the alley of this podcast. There have been a lot of shows, whether it's cable networks, podcasts, news articles, analysis. There's a lot of stuff out there about these hearings. And to try to avoid being too redundant, I opened it up for questions on our Substack page. And we'll get to those in a bit. But first, how's it going, Kristen?
It's going great. And I wanted to say congratulations, because I didn't get a chance to say that earlier. But congratulations.
Thanks.
You've had a big freaking 2 weeks, I want to say.
Yeah, new job, new wife. It's lots of life happening right now. It's a little disorienting, but it's all good stuff.
And earlier this year, I moved to Chicago, left us all, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of things happening offline right now. But let's get to this hearing. I saw Right Wing Watch had a clip featured in it. You know, I did the thing, what was that photo of, like, Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie where I'm like, that's Right Wing Watch right there. And then I would recognize that little red box in the corner anywhere. That must have been really validating. Like, how did you guys react over there? Did you know they were going to play that clip?
We had no idea they were going to play that clip. Very glad they did. It was absolutely validating after, you know, all of 2020 just trying to cover Stop the Steal, the voter fraud stories, just like from the very beginning, and just following these guys, you know, nonstop and watching all of these really crazy rallies. And so I think one of the things that we had also been talking about is this rhetoric of violence that had just been, like, all this violent rhetoric from the summer into the fall, talks of civil war. And, you know, we identified that, and we get to this point, where our minds are so poisoned that sometimes you come across some of this stuff and you're like, I think this is important. Like, I think this is very noteworthy, but nobody seems to be paying attention. So let's just clip it and put it out there and we'll see. And clearly, you know, with this one, it was absolutely the case.
Yeah, it was a clip of Stuart Rhodes speaking, correct?
Yes. Sorry, I should have said that first. But yeah, it was a clip of Stuart Rhodes calling for bloody war if Trump did not invoke the Insurrection Act and if he somehow, you know, got removed from office because he lost. And so he was just calling for, you know, war and saying that the Oath Keepers and others would have to take it into their hands.
Yeah, I totally feel the sentiment about being brain poisoned. Like, I remember watching that stuff at the time and thinking, oh, Stuart, oh, man, it's just some more Stuart Rhodes shit. And then it turned out to be pretty relevant, you know, right? Like, Stuart is full of shit. Stuart Rhodes, leader of the Oath Keepers, is full of shit a lot of the time. But I guess he was slightly more serious that time. Tell me what Right Wing Watch has been up to during these hearings. How are you all keeping up with them? Because, you know, this is, especially the hearing that was last week, you know, this is a cast of familiar characters to you all.
Yeah, so we've been covering, you know, we've been watching each of the hearings, writing some takeaway posts, and also covering the right-wing and far-right reaction to some of these hearings, which, of course, a lot of it has just been ignoring it. But some people can't help but attack and lash out at, you know, other far-right people who end up appearing in these hearings. But one of the things that we also did was that before the hearings even began, we basically looked at some of the key players in January 6th. So we looked at Ollie Alexander and the Stop the Steal movement. And we, you know, also looked at the Oath Keepers. We also looked at the role of Christian nationalism in January 6th. And so we actually created, you know, like 3 5-minute videos about that and 3 explainers. The last one is on Christian nationalism, and that'll be coming out soon. But we spent a lot of time focusing on those people because, especially with Stop the Steal, that was where all of the these far right groups, extremist groups, came together, along with some Republican congressmen and congresswomen. And political operatives. So that was one of the reasons why we focused on the Stop the Steal movement.
In the hearing this week, it swerved into the lanes that we talk about here a lot, the extremism, the internet, how online and offline interacts. We saw screenshots from that pro-Trump forum and other social media accounts expressing violent desires. We learned that far-right figures like Ollie Alexander apparently knew of these plans to go to the Capitol, which, you know, completely dispels the idea that Trump World put out that, you know, going to the Capitol, this was just some kind of spontaneous off-the-cuff thing. There was a meeting at the White House we learned about with people like Sidney Powell and Mike Flynn, who are, like, at this day and age, QAnon folk heroes, responsible for a lot of election conspiracy theories. We learned about a draft executive order to seize voting machines, which is something I saw floating around on a lot of forums, but I was like, this is some crank shit. Like, apparently that was in the White House as well. We also heard from a riot participant who kind of spoke to the effect that Trump's words had on his own conduct, whether it was his decision to go to the Capitol. And ultimately, also, I thought was interesting, his decision to leave the Capitol on that day. So that is a whole lot to unpack. That's just some of, like, my takeaways off the top of my head from that hearing. And a lot of this was not really terribly surprising to people who do the kind of work that you do or the kind of work that I do. Thankfully, the general public is not deeply poisoned on this stuff the same way that we are.
Gosh,
right?
Yeah.
You know, we look at this stuff so you all don't have to all the time. But I was curious if there was anything in the hearing this week that surprised you as somebody who looks at this stuff all the time. Or maybe there were things that you saw confirmed on the record and that felt assuring. I guess I'm asking for your takeaways here, Kristen.
I think the biggest thing for me was the fact that Trump tried to appoint Sidney Powell special counsel and may have informally done so. So this was this wild December 18th meeting between Sidney Powell, Mike Flynn, and Patrick Byrne, the former Overstock CEO. And they found their way into the White House and got an unsupervised audience with President Trump, along with Rudy Giuliani. And so both Sidney Powell and Mike Flynn, they're QAnon conspiracy theorists. They have these wild election fraud conspiracy theories that they were sharing. And so they're talking to him for 15 minutes before, you know, White House counsel Pat Cipollone gets in there and, you know, some of the more reasonable people in the Trump White House. And
which is a low bar.
Yeah. The team normal isn't quite normal, but, you know, we're just, that's what we're going to go with. But the fact that Sidney Powell comes in there, she says, you know, and all of them are advocating for Trump to seize voting machines, makes Sidney Powell like special counsel in order to do this, and then go after anybody who they think is potentially, you know, responsible for voter fraud, of which they have no evidence. And the fact that Trump is in there and he asks, you know, can I appoint her special counsel? Do I have that power to do that? And, you know, can I give her, you know, security clearance and all this type of stuff? And he gets the confirmation that he can do that. And he's like, okay, great. Apparently, according to Sidney Powell. And of course, there's some confusion there because Pat Cipollone says the paperwork was never filed. So in my opinion, she never was. But that is wild to me that you're going to have a QAnon conspiracy theorist who, you know, is so off, you know, off the rocker to become a special counsel in the Trump White House. But that was number one for me. I don't know what you thought about that one.
Yeah, it was kind of wild. I mean, I guess we knew that Sidney Powell was in the orbit. You know, she like was part of that amazing press conference where they were like, the election was stolen, and then Rudy Giuliani's face melted. But and then later, you know, Team Trump was like, actually, you know what, we have nothing to do with her. But what these hearings have been doing kind of gradually is like, as somebody who's been in this for a while, I just remember all the different points of spin and like misdirection that was attempted to try to obscure exactly what was going on here, which was the type of thing that if we saw it in any other country where it's like, oh, the, you know, if we were going to be like, oh, you know, President Bolsonaro is thinking about seizing all the voting machines because he didn't win, we'd be like, oh, that's he's trying to do a coup. And we wouldn't have any reservations about calling that what that is. But it's like, despite all this spin and all these, you know, different, like I said, attempts at misdirection, slowly but surely, like all the threads of the yarn are being unpulled. Whether it's like, oh, this was spontaneous. No, it wasn't. Oh, Sidney Powell, she wasn't actually involved. No, she was super involved. And, you know, it was considered making her special counsel to do like some kind of coup attempt thing. So all of that's kind of unraveling. I mean, I think it can be tempting to be like, well, here we have it, folks. The perfect gotcha moment. But you can't gotcha people that like aren't interested in reality. So I don't know. I guess
I hear you. Yeah. And I think for me, it's like we knew that, you know, Sidney Powell, Mike Flynn, all of these people were trying to influence the Trump White House. But I think seeing how much influence and what audience they were actually able to get with the president and like convince him is just, maybe not even convince. I think, you know, Trump is just trying to find his yes people. And it doesn't matter how crazy they are. If he finds his yes people, he's happy. But I think the fact of appointing special counsel for me, just one too many.
Yeah. And that's a good point that you bring up. It's like we knew a lot of this stuff was happening, but it is kind of astonishing to see how far it got. And really, like how close we were to something even more terrible than what we saw. Yeah. Which I think kind of leads me into the next thing before we go to the Q&A from, you know, people submitted on Twitter, people submitted on Substack. But first, you know, all of this kind of seems to be building into this crescendo. It seems like every hearing that is put on just seems to be like more insane than the others. And I thought like the first few were pretty bad, but really like looking back on it, they were just kind of setting up a foundation for the rest of this stuff. But ultimately, there's not really a legal mechanism for this committee to press charges, right? So like, who is the audience for here? I mean, obviously, the public is one audience, but you know, surely there's like a secondary audience maybe in the DOJ or something, right?
Yeah, I would say it's the DOJ, Merrick Garland, and, you know, the American people. I think, obviously, as you said, they can't bring charges. They can recommend charges to the DOJ. And I think they're trying to build the case that, you know, what Trump did was criminal, which I think there's a number of things that you can point to. But they need to have an airtight case. And so they're trying to present that to the DOJ and convince Merrick Garland that he should prosecute a former president, which, you know, has not been done before. So I think it's going to take a lot of convincing. I'm really curious to see how this last one, this last hearing that's supposed to be next Thursday, though I caution against saying last because they've changed the hearing numbers a number of times already. Hopefully they're able to bring some more evidence that is compelling for the DOJ. The other audience is the American people. And, you know, I think they're really trying to show what kind of choice that the American people have going forward. Do they want to support somebody who wanted to overturn the will of the people? Or, you know, do they want to vote for somebody who upholds democracy? And it's not a question of, you know, Democrat versus Republican, I think is what they're trying to show. But it's a question of democracy or, you know, no democracy. Which one do you want? And so I think that's the case that they're trying to build. The only problem is that you have more, you know, of the mainstream, more mainstream or big outlets. You have Fox News that's kind of covering it, but, you know.
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of, yeah. I can't even say that they fully are. But
and only and after getting, totally shamed for just not carrying it initially.
And for, you know, having Tucker Carlson have his special went for like an hour straight with no commercial breaks so people wouldn't be tempted to tune in. So I think the one problem that I'm seeing is that you have certain people who are already convinced that what Trump did was criminal. And you have other groups of people who aren't necessarily seeing these hearings. And, you know, if you're not seeing them, if you're not being presented with all this evidence, then it's hard to even, you know, make a decision about it and how you feel about it.
Yeah, definitely. It's in a newsletter I wrote recently, I kind of ended it on a similar note where it's like, you know, this is kind of why it's important that, you know, we don't just like look at this stuff online and then completely unplug, but, you know, maybe try to talk about these hearings with other people, right? And like see if we can get it past whatever. I hate when people point to the algorithm generously, but like beyond any sort of like bubbles we may find ourselves in or self-select ourselves into. So with that, let's just go straight into this Q&A. I want to say thank you to everyone who submitted questions. Some of these were such good questions that we don't really have answers to them, I'm afraid, but we'll be honest about that when we come across them. The first one is from Graf the Dad. Is there any way the committee extends these hearings, which I think you kind of already answered, Kristen, right?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. There's a possibility. You know, any single time that they get new evidence that comes in, they have somebody else who testifies. You know, I think if there's enough information there, they're going to bring in another public hearing. And you know, this has been something to reporting on this where I keep on saying, oh, you know, Benny Thompson says that the next hearing is going to be next Thursday evening in prime time. And then the second later, you know, there's another announcement. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go back in and update that story. But
yeah. And I'm thinking of stuff like, you know, Steve Bannon and Stuart Rhodes all of a sudden deciding, you know what? Actually, yeah. I might talk to the committee.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure if they do, more hearings could come about. It's totally possible. We already saw an additional hearing with Cassidy Hutchinson. So I definitely think it's on the table. Next question is from Buck Harness. Some really interesting display names came through with this. This one is, has anyone been paying attention to Trump supporters to see if any of them watched and changed their minds on Trump? I don't know a single Trumper who watched any of it. And I think you also kind of spoke to that too, right? Where it's like a lot of people, A, in this country just aren't politically engaged, period. And B, of people who are politically engaged, there's even like a smaller audience of people who are actually following along with this. There's so much information in these hearings that you kind of do have to pay like decently close attention to it to get it all. You know, even the articles that are like, here's the top three things, like that doesn't even really do it justice how insane these things have been.
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping track of each of the hearings. I've covered each one. I've written about each one. And there's just so much information and so many characters who also played a role that it's, I think it's hard for that average person to juggle it. And especially if you're only seeing snippets here and there from the conservative media that you read or you know, ingest, it's going to be hard for that to fully get through.
Yeah, I don't think the average like Ben Shapiro viewer is like watching his coverage of that and being like, you know what, maybe I misjudged this Trump guy. Yeah. And I also, you know, like to bring up, I've gotten this question from like reporters and stuff throughout the last, what has it been, a year and a half plus since this hearing. And it really can't be understated, you know, what I mentioned earlier, which is this kind of, you know, full-blown effort to obfuscate and distort what happened on January 6th to the point where polling is showing us that Republican attitudes, at the very least, have shifted on it away from being like, you know, I like Trump, but that was bad, and to, you know, getting, I think it was the Arizona Republican Party being like, that was a legitimate protest, and you know, these kind of shifting attitudes. So any work that the committee does, no matter what they unveil, they're fighting against, you know, a year and a half of really relentless misinformation and misdirection at the hand of like pro-Trump media. So the audiences of that media, you know, kind of have like a fortress around their mind palace, if you will. And I think it's going to be tough to penetrate.
Absolutely.
But again, you know, don't want to keep preaching on this soapbox too much. I think it's important that we discuss it like offline, away from media venues too. It's something I would encourage listeners to do, because people, you know, they might not trust the media. They might be skeptical of what they see online, but like people generally still have a decent amount of trust for people in their communities, people in their congregations, you know, that sort of thing. So getting these kind of conversations outside of explicitly political context, I think could be useful. The next few questions kind of all went along the same route. So I'm just going to read them all together, and then maybe we can talk about it for a minute. From Matt J., so far, all the evidence seems like it's not rock solid enough to charge the former president. But the Hutchinson and I can't pronounce this guy's name. Cipollone?
You got it.
That's it?
Yes, Cipollone. I can't spell this it, so I'm just, you know.
I read everything. I don't like watch a lot of things. So I always have to guess on some of these. Anyway, the Hutchinson and Cipollone testimony seems pretty damning for his advisors, particularly Meadows. In your opinion, is there any chance he, and I assume Matt means Trump here, faces serious legal consequences after this? Similar question from Jay Bronson. What are the mechanisms, if any, for anyone charged with a crime, impeached, or otherwise held accountable for anything being discussed by the commission? If there are none, what's the point? From Nate, we have, is anyone going to do anything with this information from the hearings? A long list of crimes is pretty useless if the criminals don't get charged. Really worse than useless, it encourages future crimes. And from Metal Chris, what exactly is the point of the January 6th hearings? It doesn't seem like anyone is going to face legal prosecution, for anything revealed in them. And Trump's base doesn't seem to care. The Republican-controlled Senate won't allow any new laws to arise from any of this either. And I think all of that is like a totally fair line of questioning. I think what's the point if nobody gets charged is a totally, totally fair question. And I mean, I wish I had a better, like, really clear, like, boom, 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 here's your answer. But a former president has never been charged by the DOJ before. The way, you know, since like the 70s, the office of the president has accumulated more and more power and more immunity throughout time, more insulation from the laws, to where we have, you know, the position of president being this like enormously powerful position, even beyond like what I imagine may have been the original vision of how this country was going to be set up. So for, you know, criminal charges and a prosecution to pursue a former president to arise, honestly, I would be surprised. I try to remain optimistic. I think there's also maybe a degree of like public influence. And at the very least, I still think, you know, a solid point of these hearings is just establishing this on the record. Whatever twisted, dark history may be ahead of us, at least we will have it in congressional record what happened, which is kind of a bleak thing to be optimistic about, I guess. But but I think that's kind of where I'm at on this. Do you have any thoughts, Kristen?
I mean, for the history books, I'm a history nerd, so absolutely. But I do think that it's important to investigate this, get the facts out there. I think, you know, there are some people who are probably in the middle and, you know, might be watching these and might need some more, you know, more information, or it might be helpful for them to see Republicans like, you know, Cipollone, Eric Hirschman, you know, White House counsel and other big names in the Republican Party essentially saying, yeah, what he did was wrong. And he knew that voter fraud didn't exist. And we told him it was illegal and he tried to do this anyways. So I think all of that is still really worthwhile. It is the question of whether he gets charged by the DOJ is just, it's a tough one. There are plenty of, you know, people who have more legal, you know, expertise who believe that he could be charged. And I think, you know, there was a recently an article out by two Republicans who were in the DOJ under Republican administrations. And they were saying, yeah, there's enough evidence. You can charge him with a crime and we should. Whether Merrick Garland or not, or will do that or not, is the big question. And I kind of agree with this, you know, I understand the frustration. If you identify all these crimes and you don't charge them, what does that mean? You know, Trump has made a career out of just getting, scuttling the law. And, you know, at some point, you'd hope that he would finally get caught. So,
yeah, like getting away with it is almost worse because they'll be like, sick, there's no consequences for this. This one's from Tyler H. What was Mark Meadows' game plan? To use the big lie as a way for him to cash out? I saw a reply to that question saying, you should definitely like torrent Mark Meadows' book. Do not buy it. Just read that section. I haven't read that section, so I don't know what that's about. But the game plan, I mean, I assume it was.
I don't know if there was a game plan, but I'm curious to hear what you think.
I don't know that there really was a coherent game plan. I think it was just kind of a power scramble, I guess. Republicans have always been much more excited to use power that they have than Democrats have been. I don't think that's a necessarily controversial statement, but it some folks may get mad at me for that.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of think they were looking around and saying, you know, Mr. Trump, I love you, Mr. Trump. What can we do? And maybe that was it. You know, I think he wants to portray himself as somebody who is like, you know, not totally down with this, but he was in a position to like slam the brakes on a lot of this stuff. And, you know, he pumped the brakes on occasion, we found out, but he didn't really act like somebody who thought this was a crisis.
He didn't.
That's my reading.
Yeah, he didn't act like somebody who was in control of his team or had any influence, because the way that he was, you know, reading his phone when bad information was coming and just saying, well, there's nothing I can do, is pretty terrible. The way that I see it for Mark Meadows is that, you know, Trump requires such loyalty. And he, you know, if Trump's asking all these things and it's hard to convince this guy to do anything that's, you know, right or following the law, I can see Mark Meadows being like, well, what options do I have? Loyalty is the one thing that matters to this guy. I have like, and, you know, I don't really think that they thought about violence, I think, in a very, sanitized way. Like the fact that violence could happen, I don't think that they really considered the real effects. I think that they were like, oh yeah, you know, something could happen, but I don't think that they really thought about what could happen.
I think a lot of people in the orbit were just kind of sitting around to see if it would work first.
Yeah.
And then when it didn't, now there's this like mea culpa about everything.
Or, it's, yeah. Or the fact that, okay, let Trump try to do all this stuff. Nothing's going to end up working. It'll be fine. And then, you know, eventually he'll just be out of office. And then it just keeps on getting worse and worse. And he keeps on going farther and farther because people have said yes to him for so long.
Yeah. So the next question is about Ray Epps, subject of a recent New York Times article. This is from Christopher Ritchie. And I think I know this name. Christopher, I'm sorry if I'm mixing you up with somebody, but I think I know this name in a negative context. But why is Ray Epps being protected? Also, sort through what would actually be admissible in actual court. How much of what was presented as evidence actually is actually hearsay? Kristen, you said you haven't gone down the Ray Epps rabbit hole before we started recording. God bless your soul.
You know, I've dipped my toes in it, and then I've said, you know, I'm going to leave this to
yeah,
to
okay, so I'll take this one. So I don't think I agree that Ray Epps is being protected. What he did was definitely bad, you know, getting in this crowd and saying, you know, we need to storm the Capitol. But doing that a day before it happens doesn't meet like the legal guidelines for a prosecution. He also didn't enter the Capitol. And most people who didn't go in haven't been charged, really. He's been interviewed by the committee multiple times. And although I thought that New York Times profile of him was maybe a bit too sympathetic and kind of left some stones unturned, particularly with Ray Epps' history with the Oath Keepers, a quote-unquote cover-up or like him being quote-unquote protected, it's not really apparent to me. It just kind of seems like he's a really high-profile example of a dynamic that has been happening throughout this investigation, which is if you flip over and turn and squeal, you know, you get a little bit softer treatment. As far as what's admissible in court, I'd say probably most of what has been in this hearing has been admissible. But of course, that comes with the huge caveat that I'm not a lawyer. I think it would largely depend on what crime you'd be trying to prosecute Trump for. Some of this testimony that we've seen has been, a degree of telephone, people hearing something that happened from others who described it to them. But in the absence of willing testimony of others, I can imagine that is probably as good as they can get for now. I think like that kind of testimony would probably be challenged in court, but it's not like that kind of testimony doesn't make it into criminal cases all the time. Yeah, I think some of it would be contested. Whether it would end up being admissible would be up to a judge, ultimately. Okay, this next one comes from Seth Rogan. Again, the usernames here are our choice. I've seen many people commenting about the recent hearings, putting pressure on Mark Meadows to testify, use the phrase carrot and stick. However, he's already been recommended for criminal contempt, and the DOJ declined to prosecute. So what stick is left? I think that's a great question.
It's a great question.
If the DOJ is not going to enforce this stuff, then what is it doing? I don't know.
The only thing I can think of is, you know, I think we saw, I don't know if they were using, you know, testimony from Cassidy Hutchinson or Cipollone and, you know, kind of like holding that over him beforehand, perhaps. Maybe there's more testimony there that they are waiting to kind of like release, but that's the only thing that I can think of. But he seems pretty damned already. I don't know. These hearings do not paint a pretty picture of Mark Meadows.
No, definitely not. This one's from Ms. Revo. Why did the committee never tie their first hearing to the one this week in regards to Proud Boys and Oath Keepers? They showed the filmmaker garage meeting footage, but never made the connection. I'm probably going to hold out on answering that one until this quote-unquote final hearing. We'll see if it is the final hearing. But I'm probably going to wait on that because we don't know what else is coming.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally fair. Now you're making me think that this final, yeah, all right. I'm excited for this final one.
Yeah, we'll see the finale. We'll see what happens.
But if they don't, then I don't know what they're doing by not, you know, making that connection in this particular.
Yeah, I mean, I also fully anticipate that there will be like a more detailed written report that comes out after these hearings.
Absolutely.
So we may also see some of the information that was, you know, cut for time from these hearings, to use a TV term, you know, maybe very well present in this larger report. And then finally, some of these are questions that, you know, as I mentioned, were just too good of questions, and I don't really know how to answer them. But in the interest of sharing those questions, because I do think they are good questions, I'll read off a few that we got. From Dapper332, why are the Republicans not concerned about finding out whom, why, and how a bomb was placed at the RNC? Why are Republicans quiet on this? Good question. I would want to know. You know, I think I would be a little more interested in who put a bomb outside my office, but...
Well, Jared, you know that they're just blaming it on Antifa, yeah, you know?
It was the Antifa FBI coalition, which famously exists, and, you know, those two groups are definitely not opposed to each other.
Have always gotten along, yeah.
From Kelly, has anyone figured out why the panic buttons were missing from some of the Democratic offices on January 6th? It's a small detail that I can't let go of, but don't ever see discussed mentioned. I feel like I had maybe heard something about this, but I think I'm in the same position as Kelly. Like,
I don't remember seeing anything after the initial reporting that they were missing.
Yeah, I would also like to know more about that. Unfortunately, I don't know. I wish I did, Kelly.
Yeah.
From America with a K, Ugly. Why did Capitol Police allow insurrectionists to illegally park? That's the big question. Because parking enforcement's like the... the most aggressive law enforcement is
in DC, especially.
Yeah, that's the most aggressive law enforcement we have. Why did they allow them to illegally park and proceed to unload enough lumber to construct a gallows on the Capitol lawn? And why did they let it remain standing for hours before the assault began? That's a great question. I would love to know the answer to that question. But law enforcement has been totally sketchy in trying to explain what happened that day. Ken Klippenstein and his colleagues at The Intercept just reported that after an inquiry, like, the Secret Service deleted all their records from, like, or text records from January 5th and 6th. I don't know. I guess that's just, like, cops for you, but it's good question. On that same note from Miss America, why wasn't there better security at the Capitol building? Why were 26,000 troops brought to D.C. after January 6th and none before? Great question. Because it seemed pretty obvious to me what was about to happen, or at the very risk.
And there was intelligence reports, too, that, you know, things could get ugly. And there's, you know, could get violent.
Yep, and it's... So... You know. Anyway, and then finally, in this list of questions that were too good, from an anonymous poster... I think this was on the Substack. It would be nice to know about Ginny's, referring to Ginny Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. It would be nice to know about her texts and involvement in Arizona with Shawana Bullock, who is a representative there that was part of the big, you know, forefront of the charge to try to dismiss election results in Arizona. And also how we can see any politicians or sheriffs running with involvement history of Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, etc. I would love to see more Ginny Thomas text messages. I would love to see all of them. You know, I have no respect for people who leak the group chat, but I do make some exceptions in politics. Leaks are good generally. So how can these politicians and sheriffs run with involvements of Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters? I think largely boils down to the fact that none of that is illegal. It's awful, but it's not criminal. And I don't think our election laws have any safeguards against that kind of thing. And I also don't know that safeguards like that would be a good idea, because you always have to imagine how that would, you know, get pushed back in the other direction. It's like, oh, this person, you know, if Trump comes back and takes over DOJ and whatever, and there was a law like that, they could say, oh, look, this candidate marched with Black Lives Matter, and we think that's an extremist group, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know.
Yeah, I'm
with
you
there. Did you want to take a deeper shot at any of those, or should we leave them on the table?
I think, you know, the only one I will say is that, just thinking about, you know, Mark Fincham running for Arizona Secretary of State, and that is alarming to me, because, you know, he said that he was a member of the Oath Keepers, and he was one of the people who, you know, really pushed the so-called Stop the Steal movement in Arizona in 2020, has just been basically trying to be in charge of that state's elections, and it's been pushing all these voter fraud conspiracies. So that for me is probably the most alarming. But, you know, as Jared was saying, it's not like we can stop somebody from running because they have an affiliation with an extremist like group, which is terrible.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like one of the more concerning things we're about to see in midterms and certainly in 2024, which is people with these extreme beliefs who don't believe in democracy engaging with the democratic process to try to like break it, essentially. Yeah. And I don't know that this country has a really robust immune response to that in a legal sense. But we'll see. I happen to know there's like a lot of legal minds and advocates and stuff thinking it through this stuff right now. But I can't help but feel the clock is ticking a bit. Mm-hmm. So that gets us to the end of the questions that we got ahead of recording. Kristen, thanks for joining. Do you have any final thoughts about these hearings that you want to share? Any words of wisdom you can impart on our listeners?
Words of wisdom. I don't know. I feel like my brain has been, you know, so poisoned by covering all of this. But I think the main thing that, you know, keeps coming back to me is how much these, you know, formerly fringe characters were really having influence in the Trump White House. And, you know, we saw that with folks like Ali Alexander, knowing that Trump was going to send tell people to march on the Capitol. The fact that he knew that is bonkers to me. You know, Ali Alexander is a far right political operative and, you know, he's advocated for violence. And the fact that he had, you know, had this information is just pretty, you know, shocking to me. So I think what these hearings are really showing is not only, you know, these connections between the far right, like the far right and the Trump White House, but as well as just like what Trump was doing during those moments and the inside look of him trying every single way he could to remain in power. So words of wisdom, I'm not sure, but I mean, I think these have been good hearings and I would highly recommend watching them if you haven't already been.
Yeah, yeah. The road was, you know, definitely a two-way street between the White House and some of these extreme elements. And I think we're definitely getting insight into the extent of that. You know, it's certainly something we knew. I mean, he had fucking Stephen Miller on his board, right? Despite everything we knew about Stephen Miller.
Reading white supremacist sites.
Appointing people like Darren Beatty to commissions and stuff. Yeah. I mean, like, it was pretty clear what was going on there. But to the extent that even these, like, wacky people like Ali Alexander, who had like took some acid a few years ago and had a now has a god complex about what he's doing. The fact that even those people had, you know, apparently a line into the White House is disturbing in the very least. And on that cheerful note, Kristen Dorer, where can people find you? Where can people keep up with the work you're doing?
You can find me on Twitter at K2Doe. And then also at Right Wing Watch. And our site is rightwingwatch.org. And you can read all of our stuff there.
Cool. And Kristen, because this is Shitpost, I have one more question. I think I forgot to tell you about this. So I'm so sorry. But what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Oh, my gosh. So I've been watching Hot Ones, which has been, you know, just after
the show where like people eat the spicy chicken wings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and it's usually celebrities and they interview them as they're slowly eating these chicken wings. I don't know. It's just, it's brought me some laughter after, you know, some terrible weeks with some, you know, pretty rough reporting. So for me, that's been my whole thing. The Idris Elba one I recommend. It's pretty great. So that's what's bringing me joy right now.
I just recommend him in general.
He's great.
Incredible. Yeah. All right, well, Kristen, thanks so much for coming on this week, and we'll chat with you later.
All right, thanks, Jared. You want to hear a good joke? Nobody speak, nobody get jokes.